Why did Stannis leave? Had he played some part in John Aaron's murder? Or was he afraid? Ned found it hard to imagine what could frighten Stannis Baratheon, who had once held Storm's End through a year of siege, surviving on rats and boot leather, while the Lords Tyrell and Redwine sat outside with their hosts banqueting in sight of his walls. "Bring me my doublet, if you would, the grey, with a direwolf sigil. I want this armor to know who I am. It might make him more forthcoming." Jorah went to the wardrobe. "Lord Renly is brother to Lord Stannis, as well as the king." "Yes, it seems that he was not invited on these rides." Ned was not sure what to make of Renly, with all his friendly ways and easy smiles. A few days passed, he had taken Ned aside to show him an exquisite rose-gold locket. Inside was a miniature, painted in the vivid Mirish style, of a lovely young girl with doe eyes and a cascade of soft brown hair. Renly had seemed anxious to know if the girl reminded him of anyone, and when Ned had no answer but a shrug, he seemed disappointed. The maid was Loras Tyrell's sister Margaery, he'd confessed. But there were those who said she looked like Lyanna. No, Ned had told him, bemused. Could it be that Lord Renly, who looked so like a young Robert, had conceived a passion for a girl he fancied to be young Lyanna? That struck him as more than passing queer. Jorah held out the doublet, and Ned slid his hands through the armhole. "Perhaps Lord Stannis will return for Robert's tourney," he said as Jorah laced the garment up the back. "That would be a stroke of fortune, my lord," Jorah said. Ned buckled on his longsword. "In other words, not bloody likely." His smile was grim. Jorah draped Ned's cloak across his shoulders and clasped it at the throat with a hand's badge of office. "The armourer lives above his shop, in a large house at the top of the Street of Steel. Alan knows the way, my lord." Ned nodded. "The gods help this putboy if he sent me off herring after shadows." It was a slim enough staff to lean on. The John Aaron that Ned Stark had known was not one to wear jeweled and silvered plate. Steel was steel. It was meant for protection, not ornament. He might have changed his views, to be sure. He would scarcely have been the first man who came to look on things differently after a few years at court. But the change was marked enough to make Ned wonder. "Is there any other service I might perform? I suppose you'd best begin visiting whorehouses." "Hard duty, my lord," Jorah grinned. "The men will be glad to help. Porter has made a fair start already." Ned's favourite horse was saddled and waiting in the yard. Varley and Jax fell in beside him as he rode through the yard. Their steel caps and shirts of mail must have been sweltering, yet they said no word of complaint. As Lord Eddard passed beneath the King's Gate into the stink of the city, his grey and white cloak streaming from his shoulders, he saw eyes everywhere and kicked his mount into a trot. His guard followed. He looked behind him frequently as they made their way through the crowded streets. Tamard and Desmond had left the castle early this morning to take up positions on the route they must take, and watch for anyone following them. But even so, Ned was uncertain. The shadow of the King's Spider and his little birds had him fretting like a maiden on a wedding night. The Street of Steel began at the market square beside the River Gate, as it was named on maps, or the Mud Gate, as it was commonly called. A mummer on stilts was striding through the throngs like some great insect, with a horde of barefoot children trailing behind him, hooting. Elsewhere, two ragged boys, no older than Bran, were dueling with sticks, to the loud encouragement of some and the furious curses of others. An old woman ended the contest by leaning out of her window and emptying a bucket of slops on the heads of the combatants. In the shadow of the wall, farmers stood beside their wagons, bellowing out, "Apples, the best apples, cheap at twice the price, and blood melons, sweet as honey, and turnips, onions, roots, here you go, here you go, turnips, Onions, roots, here you go, here. The mudgate was opened, and a squad of city watchmen stood under the portcullis, in their golden cloaks leaning on spears. When a column of riders appeared from the west, the guardsmen sprang into action, shouting commands and moving the carts and foot traffic aside to let the knight enter with his escort. The first rider, through the gate, carried a long black banner. The silk rippled in the wind like a living thing. Across the fabric was blazoned a night sky slashed with purple lightning. "Make way for Lord Berwick!" the rider shouted. "Make way for Lord Berwick!" And close behind came the young lord himself, a dashing figure on a black courser, with red gold hair and a black satin cloak dusted with stars. "Here to fight in the hands, Tawny, my lord," a guardsman called out to him. "Here to win the hands, Tawny," Lord Berwick shouted back as the crowd cheered. Ned turned off the square where the street of steel began, and followed its winding path up a long hill, past blacksmiths working at open forges, free riders haggling over mail shirts, and grizzled ironmongers selling old blades and razors from their wagons. The farther they climbed, the larger the buildings grew. The man they wanted was all the way at the top of the hill, in a huge house of timber and plaster, whose upper stories loomed over the narrow street. The double doors showed a hunting scene carved in ebony and weirwood. A pair of stone knights stood sentry at the entrance, armored in fanciful suits of polished red steel that transformed them into griffin and unicorn. Ned left his horse with Jax, and shouldered his way inside. The slim young serving girl took quick note of Ned's badge and the sigil on his doublet, and the master came hurrying out all smiles and bows. "Wine for the king's hand," he told the girl, gesturing Ned to a couch. "I am Topo Mutt, my lord. Please, please, put yourself at ease." He wore a black velvet coat, with hammers embroidered on the sleeves and silver thread. Around his neck was a heavy silver chain and a sapphire as large as a pigeon's egg. "If you are in need of new arms for the hands, Tawny, you've come to the right shop." Ned did not bother to correct him. "My work is costly, and I make no apologies for that, my lord," he said as he filled two matching silver goblets. "You will not find craftsmanship equal to mine anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms, I promise you. Visit every forge in King's Landing, if you like, and compare for yourself. Any village smith can hammer out a shirt of mail. My work is art." Ned sipped his wine and let the man go on. "The Knight of Flowers bought all his armor here," Tubbo boasted, "and many higher lords, the ones who knew fine steel, and even Lord Renly, the king's own brother. Perhaps the hand had seen Lord Renly's new armor, the green plate with the golden antlers. No other armor in the city could get that deeper green. He knew the secret of putting color in the steel itself. Paint and enamel were the crutches of a journeyman. Or mayhaps the hand wanted a blade. Tubho had learned to work Valyrian steel at the forges of Kuhor as a boy. Only a man who knew the spells could take old weapons and forge them anew. The direwolf was a sigil of our Stark, is it not? I could fashion a direwolf helm so real the children will run from you in the street," he vowed. Ned smiled. "Did you make a falcon helm for Lord Aaron?" Tophomot paused a long moment and set aside the wine. "The hand did call upon me with Lord Stannis, the king's brother. I regret to say they did not honor me with their patronage." Ned looked at the man evenly, saying nothing, waiting. He had found over the years that silence sometimes yielded more than questions, and so it was this time. "They asked to see the boy," the armorer said, "so I took them back to the forge." "The boy?" Ned echoed. He had no notion who the boy might be. "I should like to see the boy as well." Tubbermut gave him a cool, careful look. "As you wish, my lord," he said, with no trace of his former friendliness. He led Ned out of a rear door and across a narrow yard back to the cavernous stone barn where the work was done. When the armourer opened the door, the blast of hot air that came through made Ned feel as though he was walking into a dragon's mouth. Inside, a forge blazed in each corner, and the air stank of smoke and sulphur. Journeymen armourers glanced up from their hammers and tongs just long enough to wipe the sweat from their brows, while bare-chested apprentice boys worked the bellows. The master called over, a tall lad, about Rob's age, his arms and chest corded with muscle. "This is Lord Stark, the new Hand of the King," he told him, as the boy looked at Ned through sullen blue eyes and pushed back sweat-soaked hair with his fingers. Thick hair, shaggy and unkempt, and black as ink. The shadow of a new beard darkened his jaw. "This is Gendry, strong for his age, and he works hard. Show the hand that helmet you made, lad." Almost shyly, the boy led them to his bench, and a steel helm shaped like a bull's head with two great curving horns. Ned turned the helm over in his hands. It was raw steel, unpolished, but expertly shaped. "This is fine work. I would be pleased if you would let me buy it." The boy snatched it out of his hands. "It's not for sale." Tobermut looked horror-struck. "Boy, this is the king's hand. If his lordship wants this helm, make him a gift of it. He honours you by asking." "I made it for me," the boy said stubbornly. 100 pardons, my lord," his master said hurriedly to Ned. "The boy is crude, as new steel, and like new steel would profit from some beating. That helm is journeyman's work, at best. Forgive him, and I will promise I will craft you a helm like none you have ever seen."
"He has done nothing that requires my forgiveness. Gendry, when Lord Aaron came to see you, what did you talk about?"
"He asked me questions, is all, my lord."
"What sort of questions?" The boy shrugged. "How was I, and was I well treated, and if I liked the work, and stuff about my mother, who she was, and what she looked like, and all."
"What did you tell him?" Ned asked. The boy shoved a fresh fall of black hair off his forehead. "She died when I was little. She had yellow hair, and sometimes she used to sing to me, I remember. She worked in an alehouse."
"Did Lord Stannis question you as well?"
The bald one? No, not him. He never said no word, just glared at me, thought I was some raper who'd done for his daughter."
"Mind your filthy tongue," the master said. "This is the king's own hand."
The boy lowered his eyes. "A smart boy, eh? But stubborn. That helm. The others called him bull-headed, so he threw it in their teeth."
Ned touched the boy's head, fingering the thick black hair.
"Look at me, Gendry." The apprentice lifted his face. Ned studied the shape of his jaw, the eyes like blue ice.
"Yes," he thought, "I see it."
"Go back to your work, lad. I am sorry to have bothered you." He walked back to the house with the master. "Who paid the boy's apprentice fee?" he asked lightly. Mott looked fretful.
"You saw the boy, such a strong boy. Those hands of his, those hands were made for hammers. He had such promise. I took him on without a fee."
"The truth now," Ned said. "The streets are full of strong boys. The day you take on an apprentice without a fee will be the day the wall comes down. Who paid for him?"
Lord, the master said reluctantly. "He gave no name, and wore no sigil on his coat. He paid in gold, twice the customary sum, and he said he was paying once for the boy and once for my silence."
"Describe him."
He was stout, round of shoulder, not so tall as you. Brown beard, but there was a bit of red in it elsewhere. He wore a rich cloak, That I do remember. Heavy purple velvet worked with silver threads, but the hood shadowed his face, and I never did see him clear.
He hesitated a moment. My lord, I want no trouble. None of us wants trouble, but I fear these are troubled times, Master Mott, Ned said. You know who the boy is.
I'm only an armourer, my lord. I know what I'm told.
You know who the boy is, Ned repeated patiently. That is not a question.
The boy is my apprentice, the master said.
He looked Ned in the eye, stubborn as old iron.
Who he was before he came to me, that's none of my concern.
Ned nodded. He decided that he liked Tubhomot, Master Armourer. If the day ever comes when Gendry would rather wield a sword than forge one, send him to me. He has the look of a warrior. Until then, you have my thanks, Master Mott, and my promise. Should I ever want a helm to frighten children, this will be the first place I visit. His guard was waiting outside with the horses. Did you find anything, my lord? Jax asked, as Ned mounted up.
I did, Ned told him, wondering.
What had John Aaron wanted with a king's bastard? And why was it worth his life? Catelyn. My lady, you ought to cover your head, Sir Roderick told her, as their horses plodded north. You will take a chill.
It's only water, Sir Roderick, Catelyn replied. Her hair hung wet and heavy, a loose strand stuck to her forehead, and she could imagine how ragged and wild she must look, but for once she did not care. The southern rain was soft and warm. Catelyn liked the feel of it on her face, gentle as her mother's kisses. It took her back to her childhood, to long grey days at Riverrun. She remembered the godswood, drooping branches heavy with moisture, and the sound of her brother's laughter as he chased her through piles of damp leaves. She remembered making mud pies with Lysa, the weight of them, the mud slick and brown between her fingers. They had served them to Littlefinger, giggling, and he'd eaten so much mud he was sick for a week. How young they all had been. Catelyn had almost forgotten. In the north the rain fell cold and hard, and sometimes at night it turned to ice. It was as likely to kill a crop as nurture it, and it sent grown men running for the nearest shelter. That was no rain for little girls to play in.
I'm soaked through, Sir Roderick complained. Even my bones are wet.
The woods pressed close around them, and the steady pattering of rain on leaves was accompanied by the small sucking sounds the horses made as their hooves pulled free of the mud.
We will want a fire tonight, milady, and a hot meal would serve us both.
There is an inn at the crossroad up ahead, Catelyn told him. She had slept many a night there in her youth, travelling with her father. Lord Huster Tully had been a restless man in his prime, always riding somewhere. She still remembered the innkeep, a fat woman named Masha Heddle, who chewed sour leaf night and day and seemed to have an endless supply of smiles and sweet cakes for the children. The sweet cakes had been soaked with honey, rich and heavy on the tongue. But how Catelyn had dreaded those smiles! The sour leaf had stained Masha's teeth a dark red and made her smile a bloody horror.
An inn, Sir Roderick repeated wistfully. If only. But we dare not risk it. If we wish to remain unknown, I think it best we seek out some small holdfast.
He broke off as they heard sounds up the road. Splashing water, the clink of mail, a horse's whinny.
Riders, he warned, his hand dropping to the hilt of his sword. Even on the King's Road, it never hurt to be wary.
They followed the sounds around a lazy bend of the road and saw them, a column of armed men noisily fording a swollen stream. Catelyn reined up to let them pass. The banner in the hand of the foremost rider hung sodden and limp, but the guardsmen wore indigo cloaks and on their shoulders flew the silver eagle of Sigurd.
Malastroth, Sir Roderick whispered to her, as if she had not known. My lady, best pull up your hood.
Catelyn made no move. Lord Jason Malastroth himself rode with them, surrounded by his knights, his son Patrick by his side, and their squires close behind. They were riding for King's Landing and the hounds Tawny, she knew. For the past week the travellers had been thick as flies upon the King's Road. Knights and free riders, singers with their harps and drums, heavy wagons laden with hops or corn or casks of honey, traders and craftsmen and whores, and all of them moving south. She studied Lord Jason boldly. The last time she had seen him, he had been jesting with her uncle at her wedding feast. The Malastroths stood bannermen to the Tullys, and his gifts had been lavish. His brown hair was salted with white now, his face chiseled gaunt by time. Yet the years had not touched his pride. He rode like a man who feared nothing. Catelyn envied him that. She had come to fear so much. As the riders passed, Lord Jason nodded a curt greeting, but it was only a high lord's courtesy to strangers chance met on the road. There was no recognition in those fierce eyes, and his son did not even waste a look.
He did not know you, Sir Roderick said after, wondering.
He saw a pair of mud-spattered travellers by the side of the road, wet and tired. It would never occur to him to suspect that one of them was the daughter of his liege lord. I think we shall be safe enough at the inn, Sir Roderick. It was near dark when they reached it, at the crossroads north of the great confluence of the Trident. Masha Heddle was fatter and greyer than Catelyn remembered, still chewing her sour leaf, but she gave them only the most cursory of looks, with nary a hint of a ghastly red smile.
"Two rooms at the top of the stairs, that's all there is," she said, chewing all the while. "They're under the bell tower, so you won't be missing meals. Though there's some thinks it's too noisy. Can't be helped. We're full up. Or as near as makes no matter. It's those rooms or the road."
It was those rooms. Low, dusty garrets at the top of a cramped, narrow staircase.
"Leave your boots down here," Marcia told them, after she'd taken their coin. "The boy will clean them. I won't have you tracking mud up my stairs. Mind the bell. Those who come late to meals don't eat."
There were no smiles, and no mention of sweet cakes. When the supper bell rang, the sound was deafening. Catelyn had changed into dry clothes. She sat by the window, watching rain run down the pane. The glass was milky and full of bubbles, and a wet dusk was falling outside. Catelyn could just make out the muddy crossing where the two great roads met. The crossroads gave her pause. If they turned west from here, it was an easy ride down to Riverrun. Her father had always given her wise counsel when she needed it most, and she yearned to talk to him, to warn him of the gathering storm. If Winterfell needed to brace for war, how much more so Riverrun, so much closer to King's Landing, with a pyre of Casterly Rock looming to the west like a shadow. If only her father had been stronger, she might have chanced it. But Hoster Tully had been bedridden these past 2 years, and Catelyn was loath to tax him now. The eastern road was wilder and more dangerous, climbing through rocky foothills and thick forests into the mountains of the moon, past high passes and deep chasms to the Vale of Arryn and the stony fingers beyond. Above the vale, the Eyrie stood high and impregnable, its towers reaching for the sky. There she would find her sister, and perhaps some of the answers Ned sought. Surely Lysa knew more than she had dared to put in a letter. She might have the very proof that Ned needed to bring the Lannisters to ruin, and if it came to war they would need the Aerons and the Eastern Lords who owed them service. Yet the mountain road was perilous. Shadow cats prowled those passes, rock slides were common, and the mountain clans were lawless brigands, descending from the heights to rob and kill, and melting away like snow whenever the knights rode out from the vale in search of them. Even John Aaron, as great a lord as any the Airy had ever known, had always travelled in strength when he crossed the mountains. Catelyn's only strength was one elderly knight, armoured in loyalty. No, she thought, River Run and the Airy would have to wait. Her path ran north to Winterfell, where her sons and her duty were waiting for her. As soon as they were safely past the Nick, she could declare herself to one of Ned's bannermen and send riders racing ahead with orders to mount a watch on the King's Road. The rain obscured the fields beyond the crossroads, but Catelyn saw the land clear enough in her memory. The marketplace was just across the way, and the village a mile further on, half a hundred white cottages surrounding a small stone sept. There would be more now. The summer had been long and peaceful. North of here, the King's Road ran along the green fork of the Trident,